Live from New York, it's the Gary Nall Show. And now, your host, Gary Nall.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about different types of onions have anti-cancer benefits. Some new research from Cornell University. So onions can actually help prevent cancer. That's good news, and we'll share the latest. From the University of Houston, peanuts and peanut butter may hold the key to preventing obesity. A good article published in the Journal of Applied Research on Children. I'll share that with you. And research provides insights into the role of the Western diet, meaning our diet, and Alzheimer's disease, Tufts University. And also boiling coffee, well, most people boil coffee, increase the risk of prostate cancer from Cancer Weekly. And AMPK. AMPK is one of those wonderful nutrient systems in the body that makes a difference. It stands for adenosine monophosphate activated protein kinase. It's an enzyme. It's found in every cell of the body. It's considered our metabolic master switch because it controls many of the pathways that determine how we extract, store, and distribute energy from food. When we get older, we have less of it. So what can we do to get more of it and hence slow down the aging process? I'll share that and more. Also today, we're going to take an in-depth look at common pesticides can kill frogs within an hour. That's not good. Frogs eat an awful lot of insects, including mosquitoes. Well, which pesticide are we talking about? Also, Lester Brown, who we haven't heard from for a while, from Countercurrents, lays out how much will it actually cost to save our economy's foundation. So we're going to look at what it will cost us here and in other countries if we started really looking at saving our soil, saving our rainforest, because once you start using it and then more people move into an area and they start demanding more land, then you have to cut down the trees, the natural habitats are destroyed. So he came up with a formula, and it's very reasonable. This will put the test to those who say, we cannot afford to stop tearing down the jungles and the forest because people need the habitat and we need those logs. Yeah, we can. Also, Gerald Salante is going to be on today. Gerald each month comes on and gives us a forecast of what's coming. I'm going to ask Gerald about the reverse Robin Hood syndrome in our society, how big business is preying upon the poor, taking money, billions. How are they taking it? Why is no one talking about it? No one on either side. Also, we're going to have a discussion, I Don't Want to Conquer the World, by Timothy Gatto from Countercurrents. This is a direct response to those who think Bernie Sanders will be different. And adding in to Bernie's win in Michigan, congratulations, I'm going to share a commentary from Chris Hedges, Bernie Sanders' Phantom Movement. Now, I'm not asking you to accept that what Chris says is acceptable or not. Listen to his argument and then measure that argument and the merits of it with your perception of what Sanders is doing or capable of doing. Because time and again, I have found that he is right on the button. He's doing the right thing on some issues, but he's not going after the Democrats. He's not going after Hillary Clinton, except as if he were blowing, you know, bubbles in the air. He could have long ago made enough accurate, historically correct statements about her and her husband's 8 years in the White House in her years in the Senate to have completely destroyed her reputation. He hasn't touched it. Why? We'll discuss that. Time permitting, I'll open it up for calls. So we have a lot of issues to discuss. Environmental, social, health, and of course, your feedback. So let's begin. And I'm going to start with a nutrient. The nutrient is AMPK. Again, that's adenosine monophosphate activated protein kinase. We need that. Why? Because everyone knows that we age, but we don't all age at the same speed. I started doing something a long time ago. This is before anyone in the United States was talking about the association between our diet, the water we consume, our stress levels, our belief systems, our exercise as a combination. And because I was kind of starting from scratch, I decided to keep some very detailed diaries, take photographs of my friends, family members, myself every year, and then measure them, and I would look at them year to year. And you see that things are getting good, and then they're really good, and then they begin to decline. And depending upon what a person was doing, the decline was precipitous. I mean, it was really like falling off a cliff. And more often than not, this happened in a person's 40s. But again, it was, what were they doing or not doing? And at a certain point, some of my friends didn't want me to take the pictures anymore because it was too depressing to compare one year to the next. So I said, all right, let's do it decade by decade. Okay, with that, they could, well, that I would forget and they would forget, and but I didn't. So I continued to take photographs decade by decade. Then I matched them. And then I took biochemistries, very comprehensive biochemistries, and then stressed the body in different ways. Now, normally you stress the body when you eat the American diet. All those highly acidic, pro-inflammatory cytokines from hot dogs, hamburgers, french fries, coffee, sugar, soft drinks, high fructose corn syrup, meat, pork. And then you are aging the cell, but you're not noticing it. Because it's not like one day you have a bad meal and the next day you look as bad as the meal that you consumed. It's slow. And because it's so slow, and because our body is working between 40 to 100 trillion cells every single second trying to do what's right. And that itself should tell you something about the meaning and purpose of life. Let me just digress for one moment. If life is purely random and by chance, and if everything is purely evolutionary, then where does compassion come in? And I'm not referring to the compassion that one shows to another. Like I just posted a video on my Facebook of two baby chimpanzees introduced to each other for the first time. They rush towards each other. They hug each other and start kissing each other. It's just adorable. But this is also true for many species, including opposite species. But what happens when your cells, every moment of your day, when you're making incorrect choices, out of ignorance more often than not, and sometimes with complete disdain, you could care less. You want to drink, you're going to drink. You're at a party, someone gives you alcohol, you're going to drink it. Because fitting in, socializing, that form of euphoric relaxation when you're buzzed a bit, that's more important than thinking about what's going on in your liver or kidney. That's completely existential, abstract, forget about it. But the cells can't forget about it. They have to turn on over 60 different immune responses for every bad thing you do. Now, just imagine you do many bad things at once. A bun, that's acrylamide. It's a chemical that is really hard to digest. Meat that is cooked, heterocyclic amines and nitrites, very difficult to digest and a known carcinogen and very inflammatory. Alcohol. goes right through in digestion, but boy, does it create a highly acidic state, and it's corrosive to the esophagus, to the stomach lining, to the intestines, and can kill about 1 million kidney, brain, liver, and heart cells per drink of hard alcohol. That's just in one meal, and that's common. And we confuse the rituals of consumption and how we feel with what we should be consuming for an ideal state. So behind all of our missteps, there is a nonstop process of trying to undo the damage we've done. Now, it's not just in your eyes to prevent macular degeneration and cataracts, or your brain to prevent the plaque building up, the amyloid plaque that leads to Alzheimer's, the microstrokes, the little tiny specks of matter in the brain showing you've generally gotten angry and had a mini stroke, one that's so small you frequently don't notice it. You might get a little lightheaded. You might find yourself feeling that you're a little out of balance for a moment, and then the body recovers. But you had a little tiny stroke. Some people have thousands of them. And then you realize, well, your arteries are clogging, but you can't see it. You don't know it. But there's a whole system of trying to prevent that and repair the damage. Where did that knowledge come from? Think for a moment. It's not an abstract question. Where did the knowledge of what life represents and that it must be completely and totally compassionate to the biggest fools imaginable, to the real self-destructive qualities. So no matter what you're trying to do to kill yourself, your body's forgiving every second. Let's just average 60 trillion cells. You explain now how that happens randomly. You can't, it's not possible. But I could explain a different logic to it. On another program, I will. But what I'm getting to is that there are processes in the body that as we age, no matter what the body does, if you're not feeding it the tools to repair the damage, there's only so much damage it can repair because there's fewer and fewer and fewer of the reconstructive, regenerative, and repair mechanisms. One of those is AMPK. It's a very important one. So this AMPK, this adenosine monophosphate activated protein kinase, it's important, just like in all those photographs, people could see the crepey skin. Crepey skin is when you see it folding around the knees and under the arms and around the neck, around the eyes. And that's when it scares people. So we also produce less energy. And the less energy we produce, the less active we are, the less mentally active we are and physically active, but the less restorative energy there is to get us younger. So if you want to slow down and reverse much of the aging process, you must take steps to address the underlying process and make the prospect of aging less intimidating. So why do we age? Well, many factors such as hormone imbalances, inflammation, and DNA damage all synergistically contribute to the aging process. But understand something. If you were not having your hormones out of balance, coffee throws your hormones out of balance. I've helped so many women with fibrocystic breasts and ovarian tumors and uterine tumors by getting them off coffee. Coffee is a poison. Yes, you can find in the coffee bean, unprepared, you can find some antioxidants. But you boil the coffee, you just put a toxin in your body. The fact that it is a ritual that is consumed by so many people doesn't mean it's right. And that creates inflammation. Well, inflammation is the number one reason we age. It's the number one cause of disease. Why? Because it damages your DNA. The trouble is you're not eating and drinking the things that can repair the DNA. And modern research has uncovered a key culprit responsible for why our systems start to decline, and that's our levels of the AMPK. They drop. So you don't want that AMPK dropping. You want to make sure that you have it. And AMPK levels are highest in our youth, and we begin to actually age into old age at age 27. So today's lifestyles help accelerate the decline. We're doing many things wrong, and it's cultural. An entire generation has learned to socially drink, to binge drink in college, to take prescription drugs, to take amphetamine-like drugs, to help them supposedly become smarter in school and studies, the cell phones, the computers, all of these are having a negative impact upon our body. That means our energy is being used up, and that means our AMPK levels are declining much faster than what they should. Now, there's two ways to activate the AMPK. One is caloric restriction, meaning don't eat so many calories. Now, if you eat salads and greens, fresh fruits and vegetables, you're not getting a lot of calories. So that's a terrific diet. That's the only absolutely universally accepted anti-aging program is caloric restriction. Restrict the caloric intake to what your body actually needs. And that's all within our power. And next is a lack of exercise. We do not exercise. We need to be exercising. Because if you don't exercise, you get into a negative loop. Your body begins to store calories thinking you're starving. No, you're lazy. But the body doesn't know that. So it goes back to this primordial gene that says that if you are not exercising, you're probably pregnant, in which case we're going to slow down your metabolism, keep weight on your body longer, so that when you have your baby, there'll be nourishment through the breast milk and through the maternal system, metabolic system for the baby. But that isn't the way it is. You're just a couch potato, or you're finding other reasons not to exercise. Exercising 5 days a week for 1 hour stimulates the AMPK levels, and that's what's needed. And also, for those of you who want to look at natural agents, there are two. One is a Chinese herb. It's known to activate AMPK, and for this reason, it's also shown the ability to aid in glucose uptake to the cells, so it's great for diabetics and pre-diabetics. And let me give you the name of it. Gyno, G-Y-N-O, Stemma, S-T-E-M-M-A. And the second word is Penta, P-E-N-T-A, Phylum, P-H-Y-L-L-U-M. That's good. That works. The other is trans, T-R-A-N-S, tiloroside, T-I-L-I-R-O-S-I-D-E. And it activates it's an extract of rose hips, by the way. And rose hips are a great way of getting vitamin C into your system. And it activates AMPK, and so it helps you get more stable in your blood sugar. It decreases appetite. It burns fat. And all of this promotes longevity. So if you want to live a longer life, that's one way of doing it. And another, I mentioned at the beginning, that we want to look at coffee that is boiled. There's a new research out from the Norwegian Institute for Public Health, reports findings in prostate cancer, boiled coffee consumption and the risk of prostate cancer of 224,000 Norwegian men 20 to 69. My suggestion is don't drink coffee. Now, if you want to take the organic non-GMO coffee, green coffee bean, and have an extract of that, which is out on the market in any health food store, that has a lot of antioxidants. Tufts University tells us that the American diet contributes to Alzheimer's along with our sedentary lifestyle. And this was published in Nature Scientific Reports. So all you have to do is look at how bad our diet is, and it can contribute up to 25% of Alzheimer's cases. And yet we have no national program right now to educate the American public about how bad our diet is, for a simple reason. No one is going to risk in the federal government, not the Surgeon General, not the President, of saying that we have a deadly diet. We're eating ourselves to death because those are big corporations making the hamburgers and the fries and the colas and the sugar and the junk. And they have lots of lobbyists, including former legislators. So we act like it's not a problem. It is. University of Houston published in the Journal of Applied Research on Children, they found that one of the ways to reduce the risk, especially in Hispanic middle school children who are at high risk of being overweight or obese, and to reduce their body mass index, meaning the fat, is they could adhere to snacking on peanuts. And in a 12-week study, those that can, and I'm talking about organic peanuts, that was substantially beneficial to preventing obesity. Now, I would suggest you could also snack on pistachios, almonds, and walnuts, but their study was with peanuts. And finally, the benefits of onions and their anti-cancer properties. This is from Cornell University, and it says, quote, when it comes to cancer-fighting foods, onions are high on the list. But while all onions help prevent cancer due to key chemical and compounds, there are certain onions that have more anti-cancer health benefits than others, particularly when it comes to preventing the spread of colon and liver cancers. A study conducted by Cornell University food scientists looked at 10 varieties of onions and shallots. Researchers found that the western yellow, the pungent yellow, the northern red, and shallots were the highest in cancer-fighting properties. Well, the western yellow is probably the most common one there is out there. When you went to the store, you're really looking at the yellow onion, and that's it. But at least now that red onion, too, that you put in your salads, that's good as well. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a brief break and come right back. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Those of you who are supporting Jill Stein or others supporting Bernie Sanders, I want to share this. Bernie Sanders, who has attracted numerous young and white and college-educated supporters in his bid for the presidency, says he's creating a movement and promises a political revolution. We've all heard that. This rhetoric is an updated version of the change promised by the 2008 campaign of Barack Obama. According to Chris Hedges, Obama and by Jesse Jackson's earlier National Rainbow Coalition, such Democratic electoral campaigns at best raise political consciousness. That's a good thing. But they do not become movements or engender revolutions. They exist as long as election campaigns endure, and then they vanish. Sanders' campaign will be no different. You may agree or disagree, and I'd like to hear your opinion on this. No movement or political revolution will ever be built within the confines of the Democratic Party. and the repeated failure of the American left, the liberal community, to grasp the duplicitous game being played by the political elites has effectively neutered it as a political force. History, after all, should count for something. Now, the Democrats, like the Republicans, have no interest in genuine reform. You've heard me say many times in this program, I do not believe in reform, ever, at all. I believe in transform, meaning start over, everything that was wrong, correct it, the people responsible, say goodbye to them, get new people in who are not corrupted by the political system, and do it right. I also believe in creating coalitions for those who wish to work together. If I find that people don't want to work together, it's all about them, then I have no reason to support them. I cannot tell you how difficult it has been trying to get those from the Independent, the Justice, the Green parties to come together and work towards some consensus to create a viable independent party. They all want it their way. They're not interested in cooperating with other people. I wished I could tell you otherwise, because some of the people are articulate, intelligent, and many of their views are right on. But it's about them. It's not about we. If we're to succeed in the future, it has to be about we, not one personality, dynamic or otherwise, but working with many together. And here's the problem. All of these Democrats and Bernie Sanders, they speak in the language of democracy, even liberal reform and populism, but doggedly block campaign finance reform and promote an array of policies, including new trade agreements that disempower workers. They rig the elections not only with money, but also with so-called superdelegates, more than 700 delegates who are unbound among a total of more than 4,700 at the Democratic Convention. Now, Sanders may have received 60% of the vote in New Hampshire, but he came away with fewer of the state's delegates than Clinton. That's simply wrong. This is a harbinger of the campaign to come. If Sanders is denied the nomination, the Clinton machine, as corrupt and vile as it is, and the Democratic Party, even more corrupt and vile, along with their corporate puppet masters, will use every dirty trick to ensure Bernie Sanders loses. His so-called movement and political revolution will simply evaporate. His mobilized base, as was true of the Obama campaign, will be phosphorized into donor and volunteer list. The curtain will come down with a thunderclap until the next election carnival. The Democratic Party is a full partner in the corporate state. Yet Sanders, while critical of Hillary Clinton's exorbitant speaking fees from firms like Goldman Sachs, refuses to call out the party. And as Robert Scheer pointed out in a column in October, the Clintons for their role in as handmaidens of Wall Street. For Sanders, it is a lie of omission, which is still a lie. And it is a lie that makes the Vermont senator complicit in the con game being played on the American electorate by the Democratic Party establishment. Do Sanders supporters believe they can wrest power from the Democratic establishment and transform the party? Do they believe that the forces where real power lies, the military-industrial complex, Wall Street, corporations, the security and surveillance state, can be toppled by a Sanders campaign? Do they think the Democratic Party will allow itself to be ruled by Democratic procedures? Do they not accept that with the destruction of organized labor, with the destruction of the anti-war movement, the civil rights movement, the progressive movements, a destruction often orchestrated by security organs such as the FBI, the party has lurched so far right that it has remade itself into the old Republican Party? The elites use money, along with their control of the media, the courts and the legislatures, their armies of lobbyists and think tanks, to invalidate the vote. We have undergone, as John Ralston Saul has written, a corporate coup d'etat. There are no institutions left within civil society that can be accurately described as democratic. We do not live in a capitalist democracy. We live in what the political philosopher Sheldon Mollen calls a system of inverted totalitarianism. In Europe, America's Democratic Party would be a far radicalized right party. the Republican Party would be an extremist party. There is no liberal, much less left or progressive organized political class in the United States. Individuals, yes. But as a party, no. The growth of proto-fascist will be halted only when a movement on the left embraces an unequivocal militancy to defend the rights of workers and move towards the destruction of corporate power. As long as the left keeps surrendering to the Democratic Party that mouths liberal values while serving corporate interest, it will destroy itself and the values it claims to represent. It will stoke the justifiable rage of the underclass, especially the white underclass, and empower the most racist and retrograde political forces in the country. Please understand, fascism thrives not only on despair and betrayal and anger, but a bankrupt liberalism. The political system, as many Sanders supporters are about to discover, is immune to reform. The only effective resistance will be achieved through acts of sustained mass civil disobedience. The Democrats, like the Republicans, have no intention of halting the assault on our civil liberties. The expansion of imperial wars, the coddling of Wall Street, the destruction of the ecosystem by fossil fuel industry, and the impoverishment of workers. As long as the Democrats and Republicans remain in power, we are doomed. The Democratic establishment's response to any internal insurgency is to crush it, co-opt it, and rewrite the rules to make a future insurgency impossible. This was true in 1948 with Henry Wallace, and in 1972 with George McGovern, two politicians who, unlike Sanders, took on the war industry, and in 1984 and 1988, insurgencies led by Jackson. Corey Robin in Salon explained how the Clintons rose to power on this reactionary agenda. The Clintons and the Democratic establishment, he wrote, repudiated the progressive agenda of the Jackson campaign and used coded language, especially regarding law, in order to appeal to the racism of white voters. The Clintons and the party Mandrians ruthlessly disenfranchised those Jackson had mobilized. Sanders supporters can expect a similar reception. That Hillary Clinton can run a campaign that defies her long and sordid political record is one of the miracles of modern mass propaganda and a testament to the effectiveness of our political theater. Sanders said that if he does not receive the nomination, he will support the party nominee. He will not be a spoiler. If that happens, Sanders will become an obstacle to change. He will recite the mantra of the least worst. He'll become part of the Democratic establishment's campaign to neutralize the left. Sanders is, in all but title, a Democrat. He is a member of the Democratic caucus. He votes 90% of the time with the Democrats. He routinely backs appropriations for imperial wars. He actually went out on a limb saying we should give more authority and power to Saudi Arabia to do more in the Middle East. Excuse me, did I wake up and have half my brain gone? Saudi Arabia is the single greatest enemy of peace in the Middle East. And we give them the weapons of mass destruction, and they use it ruthlessly. Sanders wants more of that. Sanders is against the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He campaigned for Bill Clinton in the 1992 presidential race and against and again in 1996, after Clinton had rammed through the North American Free Trade Agreement, vastly expanding the system of mass incarceration and destroying welfare, and for John Kerry in 2004. He called on Ralph Nader in 2004 to abandon his presidential campaign. So quite simply, the Democrats recognize Bernie Sanders' value. He's a team player. They have long rewarded Sanders for his role as a sheepherder. They have not allowed anyone to run against him that would threaten his power. The Democratic power structure made a quid pro quo arrangement with Sanders. It does not run a serious candidate against him in Vermont for his U.S. Senate seat. Sanders, as part of his Faustian deal, serves one of the main impediments to building a viable third party in Vermont. If Sanders defies the Democratic Party, he will be stripped of his seniority in the Senate. He will lose his committee chairmanships. the party machine will turn him, as it did Nader, into a pariah. It will push him outside the political establishment, and Sanders probably saw his answer to what he should do as a practical response to political rally based on what they did to Ralph Nader and the heavy price Nader had to pay for his courage and his honesty. Sanders, I suspect, is acutely aware that the left is broken and disorganized. It is utterly corrupt and has been for a long time, as are its institutions and ideologues. They simply haven't been called out. The two parties have created innumerable obstacles to third parties. It is only through a third party that we can have any change in the United States. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. From all over the world, I'd like to thank you for listening, for all the stations around the United States, and for the 253 million visits in the last 12 months. We appreciate it. We have a lot of articles every day and documentaries and information from a lot of people to share with you. One of those people is on the phone right now from Kingston, New York, Gerald Salante. He is one of today's pioneers in trend strategy. He founded the Trends Research Institute in Kingston, New York, and is the publisher of the Trends Journal that has been published since 1980. And he is one of the nation's most important diagnosticians and forecasters. He is the founder of Trends TV and the co-creator of Occupy Peace Movement. Gerald is the host of Trends This Week on the Progressive Radio Network every Wednesday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Nice to have you with us today, Gerald.
Ah, great being on, and thank you for having me on Progressive Radio and Trends This Week, and for all that you do, of course.
Gerald, I'm going to start by, we're going to go down a lot. I got a lot of things for you to deal with today. First one up is, this is from Bill Quigley and from Countercurrents, and it's an article entitled Reverse Robin Hood, $6 billion businesses preying upon poor people. Quote, it's short. Many see families in poverty and seek to help them. Others see families in poverty and seek opportunities to profit from them. Let me give you six examples. One, check cashing businesses. You cash a check for $100. At Walmart, it's $3. At TD Bank, it's $5. There are 10 million households with 25 million people who don't have bank accounts, and that means it's a $100 billion industry. There are 6,500 check cashing businesses, and then you have pawn shops. More than 30 million people use pawn shops lending services, and they have, for an average loan of $150, they charge you outrageous interest, and if you don't pay, they keep your item. Overdraft fees. This is an $11 billion industry by banks. If you can't make the payment on something, or let's say if you overdraft, they charge you payday loans. This is one of the most egregious. Payday loans are used by people over 15 million times a year, and they involve an average of 391% interest, but in many cases, it's much higher than that. For example, a $300 loan where a person thought they'd be paying back $390, it was actually $975. You know, you're talking about a 300%, but they can go up to almost 1,000%, and they're making billions of dollars. Then you got car title loans. More than 2 million people use auto title loans every year. They're paying $3 billion, and what's the average annual percentage rates? 300%. Then finally, you have debt collection. It's $13 billion a year industry. They're employing 140,000 workers in 6,000 companies, and there are 77 million people who are being affected by debt collection, And you know how many calls they make a year? 1 billion, with a B, calls to consumers at all hours of the day and night, threatening them. But they're extracting lots of billions of dollars from people who are already poor. Talk about what you see happening to the 270 million Americans who are just above, below, or at the poverty level, who have no savings, who cannot go more than a week without an income, or they have no money at all, who are heavily in debt, and there is no help for them.
Well, when you talk about these loans, these payday loans and on, let's go back, because trends are, you know, how we got here, where we are, and where we're going. And the how we got here is, again, under the fraudulent belief that there's a Democratic Party and that they represent we the little people. It began under Jimmy Carter. He was the one that started getting rid of usury laws. The numbers that you read in the old days, they would have called those loan sharks. And they were only getting a small percentage compared to what these criminals are getting. So it was the Democratic Party that really put this into place. And, of course, it kept compounding with Reagan and then Bill Clinton getting in there as the ultimate fraud of being what a Democrat used to be, and the deregulation of the Glass-Steagall Act and other banking acts that made all of this possible. So that's how we got here. This would never have happened before. There would have been avenues. As far as the pawn shops go, of course, you know, that's been going on forever, but that was a small minority. So where's the country going, and what does it look like? It's very simple. All you have to do is look at the numbers, and you mentioned some of them. You have right now 51% of the American people that are working are earning under $30,000 a year. You're looking at medical costs skyrocketing, rent skyrocketing, the inability of people to buy their homes, buy homes, and just look at the latest job growth data. What did it show? Another decline in income. And remember, these numbers are cooked to begin with, and they're even showing declines. So what we have is a situation where we're back to times that are worse than the Gilded Age, and in the sense that the gap between the rich and the poor in the United States is the widest of any of the Organization of Economic Development countries, and it'll keep growing wider as more and more of Wall Street and Main Street is taken over by the criminal elites that are running the country. And again, that's not a conspiracy theory, it's a fact. And people ask me, what's the solution? It's very simple. Put back into place the laws that they deregulated, beginning with Robinson, Patman, Sherman Antitrust Act, the usury laws that I mentioned, Glass-Steagall Act. That's the only way out.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that insight. For several months, financial market analysts and economists have been warning of another economic collapse on the horizon sometimes in this year, perhaps worse than 2008. In the meantime, the meltdown hasn't arrived, but poverty continues to increase. A recent report finds 50% of American children living at or below the poverty levels. That's, you're talking then about over 30 million children, because you're looking at 0 to 18. We witnessed a dramatic fall in the stock market earlier, but then it rebounded, and yet the predictions have not been fulfilled yet. I want to know from your perspective why, and what are the largest bubbles right now to be worried about, and is it that Wall Street has discovered new and more devious means to delay financial meltdowns? It's hiding from the public. And when do you see this starting to happen, and where?
It's happening. It's the largest bubble ever created, and the big one is, of course, China. As I mentioned on Trends This Week on Progressive Radio Network, you go back 20 years ago, Gary, the total public and private debt in China was $500 billion. Today, it's over $30 trillion. You look at China's latest export numbers, they were down over 25%. Imports down double digits. China's the big one. The other one is Japan. It's unraveled. They're in a recession. They have negative interest rates. You go to Europe. Tomorrow's a big day. We're going to see whether or not the European Central Bank is going to go deeper into negative interest rates, and whether or not they're going to, how much, I shouldn't say whether or not, how much more they're going to increase their stimulus with their bond back buying schemes. It's already at 60 billion euros a month. It's going to go to 70 billion is the estimate. Why hasn't it collapsed? It has collapsed. They're propping up these phony markets with scams, and they're right in front of everybody's eyes. You watch the markets, for example, last night in Shanghai. Again, could you imagine coming out with a number that your exports decreased 25% and you're a nation dependent on exports, and your market doesn't go down? And then the next day when it does go down, it's plunging, and all of a sudden at the very end, whoop, straight line back up because of the national team, they call it. They buy back the stocks. Same thing in the United States. They have the plunge protection team. I mean, I'm not making this stuff up. It's a rigged market. It's right now in front of everybody's eyes. So how long will they be able to keep this scam going before the markets collapse, as they have been doing since the beginning of the year? It's a guess. Nobody knows, because they keep making up these schemes undreamed of. Look, you're a wonderful guy. I'm going to sell you my Swiss bonds or German bonds or Japanese bonds, and because you're such a great guy, I'm going to give you less money back than you loaned me. And you're selling these things?
Well, banks all over the world are charging negative interest rates. You put your money in there, they give you back less than what you put in. By the way, talking about banks, no one in American media is talking about Italy. Italy has the eighth largest economy in the world, and yet their banks are down almost 36% since January. We're talking about 3 months. They've lost 36%. Their banks are bankrupt. The European Union cannot afford the hundreds of billions of dollars to bail them out. And their debt to gross domestic product is 127%. And that does not include unfunded entitlements. They have a lot of entitlements there. So you're really looking at about 200% debt. So Italy is really in trouble. And if Italy falls, if its banking system falls, then you're going to see a lot of other countries in the European Union fall, and not a word about this in the United States.
And not only Italy, look at the stock values of Deutsche Bank, Commerzbank, one after another. Deutsche Bank's, from the beginning of the new year, their stock was down almost 40%. And it's the same thing with banks in America. You're looking at their stock values down over 20% since the beginning of the new year, a number of them. Follow the money. Money makes the world go around. Look at the banking crisis. You're right on target with Italy. And again, they can't get out of this problem. There's no way out, because when you look at European GDP in the last quarter, it grew the grand total of 1.5%, hardly any growth at all. And it's really only concentrated in a few countries, while the rest of them are going down. Now, you also mentioned the debt-to-GDP ratios. You're looking at China and Japan with debt-to-GDP ratios in the 250 percentiles. And again, the numbers we're getting out from China are cooked, and everybody knows it. It's probably a lot worse than that, considering what the debt I just mentioned to you is at. And again, with Japan going into negative interest rates. So the collapse has already happened, because now we have to look at what's going on in all of these emerging markets that were really growing as artificially, of course, when all the cheap quantitative easing money flowed into those markets from the United States, and China kept its Ponzi scheme going by the greatest infusion of quantitative easing in history. But now, again, China takes in about 40 to 45% of all those natural resources from those emerging markets, and now their exports are down 25%. So you're seeing currency crashes going on around the world. They're doing everything they can to prop up the commodity prices again and to prop up banking prices, because there's no way that this thing is recovering when you look at GDP growth.
When you also look at the price of oil, what do you see?
Well, the price of oil, again, is being manipulated. you're looking at the stockpiles going up to record levels, and then the only reason the price of oil goes back up again is because they're saying they're going to make a deal with OPEC and other nations that are not involved that are going to limit production to where it is and drive up the price. It's a manipulation. That has nothing to do with supply and demand. Demand is down, way too much supply, and so when the price of oil goes back up, and let's suppose it does go back up over $50 a barrel, then all of these rigs that shut down over across the United States and around the world, they start pumping again. So that lowers the price again. So our forecast is oil between the $30 and $40 range, but then put it into the bigger perspective. You need countries like Saudi Arabia, for example. They need oil at $100 a barrel to break even on their budget. And now you're seeing downgrades by Moody's of Kuwait, of Saudi Arabia, of Bahrain, of Qatar. Oh, hey, everybody, you miss Al Jazeera? That's owned by the Qatar government. Guess what? They're firing people like crazy because they can't support the system anymore with the low oil prices.
Gerald, my last thought deals with the millennials. The millennials have an opportunity to push back against the privatization of our educational system, the high cost of a college education, the bankruptcy laws that were fixed so they couldn't declare bankruptcy, get out of their loans, they can go to debtors' prisons. U.S. Marshals are now arresting students who are back on their loans. So give us your perspective on what lessons must the millennials learn so that they can move forward collectively and be a part of positive change.
We have a story in the Current Trends Journal, Millennials. It's written by a real millennial guy that's really into the system. And it says, quote, "The change, the world shtick is a front. Apathy rules this generation for now." And that's by Timothy Malcolm. You look at the millennials, for example, that are pushing for Bernie Sanders. Why are they going for him? He's promising them free education and saying all the populist things. But the millennials themselves don't have the drive, as we see it right now. They're not in the forefront of any movement. And what's going to take the change, as we see it, is our generation, the baby boom generation, to lead the charge and for them to follow it. And Bernie Sanders is the perfect example of doing it in a way that's only self-serving rather than for them. And by the way, you mentioned about how they become, you know, it's a debtor's prison. You're an indentured servant because of your college loans. That was put in place, by the way. It was underway during the Clinton administration. He's the one that pushed it. Joe Biden was a major pusher of it. And then it was passed finally into the early years of the Bush administration. Just to put it into perspective of why they are where they're at. And again, now they're supporting the Democratic Party. So right now, we don't see the millennials. The millennials are more talk than action, and they do it with every generation. As a guy that studies trends, I remember when the Generation Y came out, and they're saying things like, you know, you can't con these kids. They're really smart. You could get them to drink phosphorescent Slurpees. You're young, you're malleable, and it's up to us, I believe, all working together, not any generation, but a generation blending from the boomers to the millennials to make the change happen. And again, you can see how they lockstep into a message by the way they're following Sanders.
Gerald Celante, Gerald, thank you for coming on and giving us your projections and insights.
Ah, great. Thanks for having me on. Always great being on with you, Gary.
His program is called Trends This Week on the Progressive Radio Network every Wednesday at 11 a.m., and his website is trendsresearch.com, occupypeace.us. Thank you, Gerald. I want to thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow.